NetCredit is here to say yes to a personal loan or line of credit when other lenders say no. Apply in minutes and get a decision as soon as the same day. Loans offered by NetCredit or lending partner banks and serviced by NetCredit. Application subject to review and approval. Learn more at netcredit.com/partner. NetCredit, credit to the people.
To realize the future America needs, we understand what's needed from us. To face each threat head on, we've earned our place in the fight for our nation's future. We are Marines. We were made for this.
Talking history. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auchteroin, Argus, Akoiza.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, we're talking to Diarmaid Ferriter about how Ireland was transformed over the past 25 years. We'll bring you the untold story of the women of Wall Street, the misogyny they faced and how they overcame it. And to end the show, we'll find out how the IRB, the Irish Republican Brotherhood, changed the course of Irish history as we look at their role in the 1916 Rising, the War of Independence, and how its members responded to the treaty. You can email us your thoughts and views, talkinghistory@newstalk.com, and we'd love to hear from you. Well, to begin tonight's show, I'm delighted to be joined by Professor Diarmaid Ferriter, whose new book, The Revelation of Ireland, looks at the period 1995 to 2020. It's published in hardback by Profile Books and has been praised already as being forensic and insightful, a major achievement, and praised for telling the latest chapter in Ireland's story with authority and insight. Diarmaid, you're very welcome back to the show.
Lovely to talk to you, Patrick.
So can you tell me, first of all, maybe the challenges involved in dealing with this very contemporary period of Irish history and trying to bring it in, I suppose, in a fresh way for our listeners?
Yeah, it was a very different kind of challenge because obviously most of the areas that I've been looking at before have been further away. And it does raise this question about distance and perspective. And I suppose I was very conscious as a historian as well that you are professionally trained to try and objectively analyse evidence and do your research in that way, but you can't step outside of the time that you live in or that you have lived through or that you were reared in. So, you know, you do have your own strong views about various things that have dominated public discourse and current affairs. So the challenge really is, I suppose, to try and look at relatively recent events through a very long historical lens. And I do remember when things got difficult, particularly during the economic crash, being infuriated by the constant assertion by our political leaders, we are where we are. And it was like a red flag to a historian bull, because I was asking, well, why are we where we are? And you have to kind of dig a bit deeper. And I did feel as well that because we're living in an era of such speed of access to information and social media overload and you know, the constant news cycle, that there is, I think, a role for the historian to take a step back and try and distinguish between, you know, what is factual, what is evidence, what is proper analysis, and what is just distortion and propaganda. And, you know, there was a line I used there taken from a book by Richard Fisher last year, a BBC journalist, and he referred to the tyranny of the instant, which can be, you know, quite a challenge for a historian to try and get beyond that. So I think that was one of the challenges, but also dealing with the sheer avalanche of digital information that we now have. I mean, when I was writing history 20, 25 years ago, there's very little reliance on websites and on digital sources, whereas now we have an avalanche of material. And it's fantastic in the sense that it's really democratized access to information. But I think it also needs to be mediated. It needs to be sifted through. There's a tendency too much to rely on kind of executive summaries of very detailed reports and very difficult things. And that was part of the challenge. But also, I think, coming to terms with just the scale of revelations. Since I've been an adult, we've been dealing with the exposure, I suppose, of very difficult aspects of our past. And I was actually reading Anne Enright's book, The Gathering, while I was working on this book. And It kind of went to a heart of that idea of trying to come to terms with public and private pasts. And the protagonist in that book refers to trying to bear witness to an uncertain event. And she says she feels it roaring inside her. And it's about a family secret and what might have happened to her younger brother. And it struck me, I suppose, that, you know, what hurt may linger in the bones, that kind of theme that she's exploring, was had a much, much wider relevance to us as a society. But I think the historian has to get beyond anger and beyond roaring, you know.
And you talk about that in your introduction to the book. And when you talk about the revelations of clerical abuse and how that transformed Ireland's relationship with the Catholic Church, do you see this as being a period where the Catholic Church's authority was just eviscerated?
Well, it was. And I mean, its credibility was eroded. There's no doubt about that, because, I mean, we associated the Church very much with having almost a monopoly on defining moral principles and transgressions and how we should be leading good Christian lives. And I suppose there was an exposure of an awful lot of blatant hypocrisies and lies, but also that idea that they should be and could be authoritative when it came to matters affecting people in their everyday lives. I mean, they did have that dominance, they did have that power, and of course it was abused. And I suppose I was really struck, having grown up in Ireland in the 1970s and 1980s, in what was still a very Catholic-drenched society, just how it began to crumble, that sense of authority, that sense of certainty. And yet, at the same time, of course, I was very interested in trying to understand that deeper question of how that power had been created in the first place. But certainly, there was you could see that new irreverence emerging. I remember as a student, actually, when the Bishop Eamon Casey scandal broke, this was Ireland's perhaps most popular and best-known bishop in 1992, Eamon Casey, and he had been exposed as living a double life and had fathered a child with his lover Annie back in the 1970s. And I remember crossing O'Connell Street and there were T-shirt vendors selling T-shirts emblazoned with the slogan, "Wear a condom just in Casey." And I remember feeling there was a real new irreverence there and a sense that they deserved to be ridiculed. But of course, there was something much darker and much deeper in terms of what was revealed subsequently. And that has been a real, real challenge, I suppose, because you can't understand modern Ireland as a historian unless you try and understand the Catholic Church. And we can't just see the Catholic Church through the scandal-inspired lens either, because it goes much deeper than that. And of course, it reveals much about us as a people and our identity. So I was kind of interested in the different mediating structures through which people experienced their Catholicism, because I don't think it's true to say that we're a completely post-Catholic country at this stage. There's still huge control of education in relation to the Catholic Church in particular. And also that sense that there's a very strong bedrock of popular culture around Catholicism, notwithstanding all of the difficulties. But certainly in terms of the status and the power and the authority that it's had, I mean, that has been a really noticeable change.
You also talk about the changes in Irish political culture over this 25-year period. And of course, the 2011 election when Fianna Fáil suffered so badly. In a way, the decline of Fianna Fáil was part of that reshaping of Ireland's political landscape.
Oh, it was. There's no doubt about that. And again, we have to remember just how successful Fianna Fáil had been. I mean, it was one of the most successful political parties anywhere in the world when you look at it from its foundation in the 1920s. So the scale of that collapse in 2011 was particularly striking. But what I found interesting from a political culture point of view was perhaps just how conservative we are. We didn't embrace a completely new political dawn. There wasn't the emergence of a very coherent, obvious new political movement that would replace that dominance. What we had instead, of course, was the emergence of Fine Gael as the victor in 2011. And I suppose we swapped Fianna Fáil for Fine Gael in some ways. But what the collapse of Fianna Fáil did do is it opened up a particular space. It's a very fractured space. Obviously, Sinn Féin benefited from it. Independence benefited from it. Fianna Fáil didn't recover to achieve the kind of heights that they had done in their heyday, but they did recover nonetheless. But it certainly created a much more fractured space. But it struck me in looking back at the crash in particular that there were those, including political scientists, suggesting that there was an opportunity there for a new kind of political force to emerge in Ireland to challenge the existing model and the existing ways of doing things. And that didn't really transpire as a coherent, realistic prospect. It was really fractured. And in some respects, I suppose Sinn Féin were trying to do what Fianna Fáil had done in its early days, which was kind of mop up the votes of the disaffected, or the men of no property, as they were famously called. But it just led to a much more fractured space. And we're still dealing with that now. And it struck me, even in terms of recent political debate in the context of the general election and that we still tend to rely, I suppose, on a lot of the old ways of thinking and talking about politics. We didn't necessarily, as a result of the upheavals and the economic upheavals, we didn't necessarily learn a new language, and Ireland didn't necessarily embrace the idea of a completely different ways of doing things politically.
You suggest that humiliation soon turned to smugness, and that we were always concerned with being validated externally rather than really having the self-confidence to chart a new course for ourselves.
Well, this is the interesting thing about globalization, I suppose, because, I mean, we're familiar with some of the assertions that have been made about how Ireland can thrive as a small, open economy. And we had these slogans around Ireland being the best place in the world in which to do business and so on. They do seem a bit hollow to me. I mean, many of Ireland's diplomats have been quite canny in ensuring that Ireland can benefit from international developments or international shifts. But it also involves, I suppose, a certain denial of our dependence on others. I think some of these issues are coming under much more scrutiny now in relation to security and defence and energy and even climate change. That a country that has been quite clever in how it managed its foreign policy and how it managed its relationship with the rest of the world has also been exposed, I suppose, as being quite vulnerable and being overly dependent. And it raises this interesting idea of what an independent foreign policy actually means in the early 21st century. And the smugness I'm talking about, part of it was around this idea, to use that cliche, that we were always punching above our weight, you know, that we could send 35 or 40 government members around the world as part of the St. Patrick's Day exodus and the reach of the Irish diaspora and so on. But, you know, there's a limit to that, and there's a certain shallowness to that when it comes to fundamental questions of how Ireland can actually make a difference to the world. You know, there tended to be an emphasis on the idea that Ireland carried a certain moral authority arising from its own history of colonization and could speak up for oppressed people. But in reality, there's an awful lot of compartmentalization. I mean, I remember there being an extraordinarily well-attended march against the Iraq invasion at the time that Bush was president of the United States. And Bertie Ahern, who was Taoiseach at the time, was saying that he was fully in support of these marchers, but at the same time, he was going to facilitate the American war effort through Shannon Airport because we couldn't cut off our nose to spite our face, you know. And it's this question of what value you actually place on being truly independent.
And that leads into a fascinating chapter on the peace process. And you do talk about the personal relationship between Bertie Ahern and Tony Blair and how important that was, but also the fact that officials and those involved on both sides saw this as very much a joint project.
Oh, they did very much. I mean, it's a privilege in a way to be in the room with an awful lot of these negotiators. I mean, we have access to the archive of the peace process now in both Belfast and Dublin, but of course also London. And you get a really strong sense of what was involved in the mechanics of it, what was going on behind the scenes. How do individuals make the time available to try and solve what has been an intractable problem? And even the idea of a British Prime Minister clearing the decks in order to try and focus on this problem. I mean, John Major, who was in office before Tony Blair, he said to him when he was coming in, if you are serious about Northern Ireland, you have to devote an extraordinary amount of time to it. That might seem obvious to us, but for a British Prime Minister, that involves a fundamental shift in thinking, because it's not necessarily a British political priority or a priority for their electorate. But I suppose Blair also saw an opportunity, and he had considerable ego, to mark his place in history as somebody who could actually take this on. And that dynamic, those personal dynamics become very important. We have the transcript of all the phone calls, for example, between Bertie Ahern and Tony Blair. And that mattered, that they weren't necessarily carrying as much baggage as their predecessors, that they were able to communicate with each other in a particular way, that they were both young, they were hungry for success. But they also, of course, faced a very, very difficult political landscape and all the conundrums that came with Northern Ireland and the frustration that can emerge as well. But also how the parties that are involved in the process deal with the challenge of selling compromise to their constituencies, who are often so entrenched, and how that is spun, how it is communicated, and you know the tensions that are constantly there. I mean, David Trimble emerges as a fascinating character in terms of the dilemma that he had, and but also how Tony Blair and Bertie Ahern managed him, and you know, keeping the Paisley wolf from the door, and how Sinn Féin managed the idea of selling as a success, something that is so far removed from their fundamental principles. So, you know, it is about managing that process. But there's also then the very interesting post-peace process generation of voices, including the great writers in Northern Ireland, who are asking the bigger questions, not just about getting an agreement over the line, but how do you actually make the transition to a shared society? What's involved in recovering from the Troubles? What's involved in legacy? And how do you make sense of a narrative for your community that might be crumbling, that might not make sense anymore? And the way Leah Saudi, a young writer who moved to Cookstown in 1998, put it, too many of them started to choose hatred over mediocrity. They couldn't cope with the idea that what they had clung to, that what they relied on, was no longer credible. And, you know, that can do dark things and push people in dark directions. So there's an awful lot there about the mechanics of a peace process and what's involved for the diplomats and the negotiators, but also what it actually means on the ground.
You also look at cultural expression, literature and music and so on, and how Irish voices have engaged in global arenas and perhaps showcasing a more self-confident Ireland.
Well, I think it's one of the best assets that we have. And I mean, I don't want this book to be seen as a narrative of a failed state. We've all sorts of persistent problems in relation to the social contract in particular, and people's expectations around health and housing. But I mean, I remember asking that question during the economic crash. What does Ireland have to offer to the world that's unique, that's distinct, that can make us proud? And culture is one of them. The skill of our writers, the skill of our musicians, and the sense in which the words and the music can travel and can be reinterpreted and can have that kind of life well beyond Ireland, and the confidence that it can bring. I mean, people often cite the example of Riverdance, you know, and the Irish dancing, you know, but I was making the point that that was just a stage in what had been a very, very long story about how Irish culture had emerged and could be reimagined at various stages and can strike an emotional chord with people as well. And I mean, it's important for us to remember how various generations of writers and their artists and their playwrights and their novelists, you know, have tackled the big Irish questions, but also made them their own and have asked new questions. And we often talk about a very successful generation of younger men and women writing in Ireland now. And they're writing in a very different way, and they're writing about very different things, or else they're updating old themes. And it's certainly something that has meant that even in very difficult times, there's a strong sense of cultural robustness. And I would never underestimate that as a historian, because it's a great solace for people, but it's also a considerable source of pride.
Okay, well, I think that's an excellent note on which to end our discussion with Professor Diarmaid Farrater. The book is called The Revelation of Ireland, 1995 to 2020. It's published in hardback by Profile Books. The author, Diarmaid Farrater. And Diarmaid, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Pleasure, Pat.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
The wrongs we must right, the fights we must win, the future we must secure together for our nation. This is what's in front of us. This determines what's next for all of us. We are Marines. We were made for this.
Welcome back. We're Talking History. They broke down the doors of Wall Street's Old Boys Club, finding their first foothold in small brokerage houses before making their way into investment banks and exchange floors. And a new book tells the inside story of how women infiltrated Wall Street from the swinging 60s, a time when no lady signs hung across the doors of its luncheon clubs and more discreetly inside its brokerage houses and investment banks, all the way up to September the 11th. The book is called She Wolves: The Untold History of Women on Wall Street. It's published in hardback by John Murray. The author is Paulina Brenn. And Paulina, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Oh, thank you so much. It's lovely to be here.
Can I begin just going straight into some of the scandals of the 1980s? Because what I found extraordinary was when you had all of these cases of insider trading and big investigations and people going to jail, you didn't have women going to jail. And one of the reasons was because they were excluded from this inner network, which included the insider trading. So it wasn't that they had the opportunity to insider trade and just didn't take it. It was another example of how they were excluded and cut out of things.
Exactly, exactly. And in some ways, it was a shock to the women who'd come to Wall Street in the early 1980s when there was this sort of enormous deluge of people coming to Wall Street. Wall Street just exploded. They needed bodies. It was expanding that quickly. And so, in a sense, they were less discriminatory what kind of bodies. So you had a very different type of woman coming to Wall Street in the early 1980s. These were women, unlike the ones before, who had degrees from the fancy Ivy League universities. They had MBAs. And they thought that, first, Wall Street could just go up, up, up. Second, they thought that they were truly the beneficiaries of the women's movement. And that sort of all exploded in 1987 with the great sort of crisis, the first time they'd seen a crisis. And it exposed those two things. One, Wall Street doesn't always go up, up, up. And the other thing, perhaps more importantly, certainly for my book, is the fact that women who thought they were sort of on the inside now really weren't.
And it's an extraordinary story, and it's an extraordinary story about the obstacles that so many women faced, that it really was a kind of a boys' club and the men were determined to keep it a boys' club.
Absolutely. I mean, one really hears this, oh, Wall Street was an old boys' club, maybe it's still an old boys' club. But I came to this as a historian and a writer, not a finance person, as somebody who was really interested in discovering this place called Wall Street. And it was fascinating. And indeed, the extent to which it was an old boys club was astonishing. The other thing that was really surprising to me is how Wall Street, just the look, the feel of it, has changed so radically. Because my timeline for the book, I do then at the end ruminate on the present, but it's really from the 1950s to 9/11. So it's those 50 years. And when the women start coming, especially in the 1960s, they start very slowly coming in. It's such a different world. There are, as you said in the introduction, there are all the big name firms that we know now, some of which have also disappeared, of course, like Lehman and Bear Stearns. But there were hundreds of little brokerage houses where the women were able to sort of pry open the door. And that's where it began. Of course, they were able to pry open the door of these small brokerage firms because they could multitask and they were very, very cheap. So that is the way they found their way in as receptionists, as secretaries. And then very slowly, the next step for those who decided they were going to try to sort of climb that treacherous ladder was actually in the research department of these brokerage houses, because research itself, it wasn't front-facing, it wasn't profit-making. Already sort of, it was where the nerdy men were. So it was a feminized space, so women could sort of find their way there as research analysts, meaning that they would analyze, they would do the research on a particular industry, and they would become experts on that, and they would recommend stock. And the other handy thing was that when they handed in their reports, they most often did not have to put their full name there. They put their initials. And so it would be years before often men understood that they were actually giving the stock advice of women. So that was one way that they were able to sort of infiltrate at the beginning.
And Education, of course, is a crucial factor in all of these things. And, of course, there's a huge obstacle if places like Harvard Business School aren't accepting women. And it's only in the 1960s that mm-hmm. that changes. And even then you see the sexism in the way you have one 20-year-old English major at Stanford. She was the first woman to be accepted, but she was described by the Boston Herald as the blonde bomb. So it's all about creating an image then and labelling these women who are accepted. There's only 8 on that first program, 624 men, but only 8 women.
Exactly. And those poor 8 women, oh my goodness. First of all, they were certainly certainly right to be there because the admissions office had been told they have to pick those first 8 women to be women who could never fail, who are that smart, because they didn't want to see them fail. It would not look good for the Harvard Business School. But those 8 women, I mean, they arrived, they were completely isolated. I mean, physically isolated, you know, psychologically, emotionally. And when recruiting season came in the spring of the second year, they would try to sign up for just interviews. And they'd try, again, they'd try to use initials and they'd walk in and, of course, sort of expose themselves as women. And often the men in the room would just start laughing or tell them, in one case, said, oh, we just hired a woman 3 years ago. We're waiting to see how that goes. So it was quite something. So interestingly enough, the women who were sort of climbing that ladder in the 60s and the 70s on Wall Street, they were not necessarily coming from MBA programs because that particular route was not proving as sort of as useful as the other route, which was to go through the secretarial route. And these women, what was very interesting to me, because, of course, we have this idea, as I said, of the 1980s, the Wall Street woman, the power shoulders, you know, the MBA, the briefcase and everything. In the 60s and 70s, these were actually women who, some of them had college degrees, many of them, especially the ones that became successful, were actually college dropouts. They were from the outer boroughs of New York, meaning they were from Brooklyn and Queens and Staten Island, so not posh Manhattan. So it was a very different profile. And in some way, they were able to succeed, I think, because in many cases, they'd already sort of learned to have a thick skin. And so it was a certain type of personality. And then the other thing that was, well, there's so many things, frankly, that I found fascinating as somebody who was just entering this world for the first time. The other interesting thing was how different the women who end up going into investment banks and brokerage houses, how different they were from the women on the exchange floors.
And what do you see as the big difference, just that in terms of the way they approached it or the way they were treated?
Well, speaking of sort of this demographic of, you know, who's coming to Wall Street, at the very beginning of my research, I was talking to a woman, Doreen, who becomes a character in my book, and she worked on the American Stock Exchange floor and the New York Stock Exchange floor. And she said she had tried to go to one of these Financial Women's Association meetings, and she'd left because those were not her kind of women. I said, what do you mean? And she said, well, the difference between the investment and brokerage side and the trading floor side was brains and brawn. And I was like, really? And you know, a year later, I understood what she was saying. She was wrong in the sense that if you were on exchange floors, you had to have brains too. But I got her point. I certainly understood it a year or so later after having done many interviews and much research. These women on the exchange floors, they had to tough it out in a very particular way. But what was, and I'll get to that because it's quite fascinating, but what was surprising was as sort of this odd type of sexist meritocracy, you could say, started to narrow in the 1980s, when at that point, if you were going to come in as a secretary, you're probably going to stay as a secretary. The exchange floors somehow continued to be a form of meritocracy. You could come in as a clerk and you could end up as a floor broker. And so that it, they had very different, the women and the places had very different personalities. But the exchange floors, I mean, famously the New York Stock Exchange floor, if there's one person anybody has heard of on Wall Street historically from the post-war era, it's Mickey Siebert. And Mickey Siebert was just this icon on Wall Street. She arrived in 1954 in New York, also had dropped out of college in a beat up Studebaker with $100 in her pocket. And she also, she clawed her way up to become a famous research analyst in aviation. She hopped from one brokerage firm to another, trying to get promotions, which she did, but she was always outsalaried by the men. And finally, she'd had enough. And a friend suggested she try to buy a seat on the New York Stock Exchange, and no woman had ever done that. And with great difficulty, she ended up doing it for what was, you know, equivalent today of $4 million. And she became the first woman to have a seat starting January 1st, 1968. But she did not go down on that floor to trade because, as she said, she could not afford to get more enemies. And she was right. The first woman to actually go down on the New York Stock Exchange and trade was in 1976, Alice Jocko. She had to be persuaded because she knew it was going to be brutal, but it was worse than she ever imagined.
Yeah, they sent dildos down the pneumatic troops instead of stock orders. So, like, an incredible misogyny on display there.
It was remarkable. She had to have a police escort at a certain point because of all the threatening anonymous calls she was getting. And the thing is, she said to me, she thought it would let up. She ended up being there for 4 years. And she did it because it was a stepping stone and it took her where she needed to go. But she said she really thought that as they got to know her, that simply this would, you know, let off a bit. But it was a different group that went after her at different times. So once she was there for a year and she was making really big trades, the upper echelons, the so-called specialists on the floor, those people had to respect her. But then it was actually sort of the people like her. She was also from the outer boroughs. They started going after her. So in those 4 years, she led the way, and then women slowly came onto the floor and had an easier time of it. But hers was remarkable.
Tell me about Francine Gottfried, because she became known as the sweater girl. But what her story, I think, really illustrates is just how crazed the men were, that they had all this responsibility and yet they were acting like, you know, 12-year-old schoolboys or something. And the way that the story of her was covered in the New York Times when she wouldn't turn up on a particular day, like, it was just a kind of an hysteria.
Yes, and it goes back to so many things we've been talking about, the old boys club. I mean, it was a perfect sort of enlarged example of that. So what happened was Francine Gottfried was just one of these women, again, from Brooklyn. She was hired as a data entry clerk. And this is happening in the same year that Mickey Siebert is getting a seat on the New York Stock Exchange. So talk about contrast. It really gives you a sense of that on Wall Street in these early years. So she's getting a seat on the stock exchange. And Francine Gottfried, young woman with an enormous chest, gets a job as a data entry clerk and emerges from the subway from Brooklyn onto Wall Street at a certain time. And men see her. They tell other men on Wall Street. And it becomes a phenomenon to catch sight of the sweater girl, Francine Gottfried, emerging from the subway. She also has to have a police escort at some point. By the end of the summer, there's something like 15, there's a photo in my book of just thousands of men waiting. And it was something like 15,000 men. There were police everywhere. Things were destroyed because men were climbing onto lampposts to see Francine Gottfried. And exactly, and she's, every single newspaper carried the story. And she said, exactly, she said, like, I don't understand it. These men are supposed to, like, they're powerful. They're taking charge of our money. They're ruling Wall Street. Why are they acting like this? I don't understand. And, you know, she had a point, right? As you say, it was this incredible hysteria taking place.
And you can kind of understand the mindset, or what's indoctrinating or kind of encouraging this mindset, because when people would apply for to some of these major firms like Merrill Lynch, they would be asked questions such as, what interests you most about a woman you meet? And then it was a multiple choice question. So the possible answers were beauty, intelligence, dependency, independence, and so on. And one woman who was applying picked intelligence, but that was wrong. So there was no points for that. You would get 1 point if you had picked beauty. You would get 2 points points if you had picked dependency. So the types of questions that were being asked was kind of almost encouraging this mindset, or certainly playing into it.
Absolutely. And then, ironically, this woman this happened to, and she sort of put two and two together and realized what was happening, Helen O'Bannon, she took Lehman to court. And basically, these questions were there, as you say, exactly these questions. And in part, it was reflective of the place. But in part, it was also intentionally a barrier for women to pass this test so they could become trainee brokers at Lehman Brothers. So it was intentional, and it was absolutely part of the whole environment. The stories are remarkable. I mean, there was one of my favorite. It's just sort of a passing story, but it says so much. Is this moment, also I believe it was in the 60s, and a woman was invited to give a keynote speech at a luncheon. It was a luncheon in typically in a dining club that did not allow for women to come in. Some of them had back entrances called ladies' entrances where women could enter, and some simply did not. This one did not. So she had to climb up the fire escape. The men who were there to hear her speech helped her through the window. She gave her speech, and then they helped her out the window, and she climbed back down the fire escape. So I feel that's sort of a story that really encapsulates these early years. And of course, what happens is these women who then come in the 80s who don't know this history, who think that they're different, who think these women of an older generation are very aggressive because they've had to be, there's tremendous tension between these two generations.
A beautiful story, so well told. She Wolves, The Untold History of Women on Wall Street. It's published in hardback by John Murray. The author is Paulina Brown. And Paulina, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this. Welcome back to Talking History. A new book delves into the secretive world of the Irish Republican Brotherhood, the IRB, and its profound impact on Ireland's political landscape between 1914 and 1924. And with the aid of new documentation, it unravels the true influence of this oath-bound society, without which the 1916 Rising might never have taken shape. The book is called The Irish Republican Brotherhood, 1914 to 1924. It's published in hardback by Irish Academic Press. The author is John O'Byrne Ranala. And John, you're very welcome to the show.
Thanks, Patrick.
It's really interesting, the IRB, because they've been very much overshadowed by the IRA, even in terms of the popular memory of the revolutionary decade of 1913 to 1924. And in many ways, their impact and their influence has been largely, I suppose, forgotten about.
Well, I think The trouble is that the IRA, as you suggest, took over the narrative, and reference to the IRA took over the story. But in fact, the IRA was created by the IRB, a point that Michael Collins insists upon making several times. And in 1916, it was the IRB's army, the IRA, that they maintained had took over the GPO and took to the streets. I interviewed over 100 people for this book. 50 years ago. But as one of them said, the IRA swallowed the IRB. And that is, in effect, what happened. But in doing so, this has contributed to a mythology of Irish history, which has been rather destructive.
So tell me about the IRB, because you mentioned Michael Collins there, and Michael Collins really was central to the story of the IRB in this period, and he saw them as the true custodian of the Irish Republic.
That's correct. The IRB was started in 1858 by a fellow called James Stevens, who, by his own account, walked 3,000 miles around Ireland recruiting likely lads. It was dedicated from the outset to force. The point about the IRB was the renunciation of democratic procedures, the renunciation of constitutionalism, if you like, and it had determined, as had Wolfe Tone, whom they looked to as their intellectual forebear, they were determined that Irish freedom could only be obtained by force, and therefore they saw it was just a waste of time to play with anything else. They launched various unsuccessful insurrections, They created Clan the Gael in the United States from 1867 to 71. The Clan, in the form of the Fenians, which became the name, the name generally applied to all of them, launched attacks on Canada until the American government said that's enough and stop it. So they did. But they then went on to become less, if you like, revolutionary. And at one stage, three quarters of the Irish Parliamentary Party under Parnell had been or were members of the IRB. The IRB was started by James Stephens in 1858, St. Patrick's Day 1858, in Dublin, having spent time walking, by his own account, 3,000 miles around Ireland, recruiting young men to this secret society, which he modeled on a loose association of European secret societies called the Carbonari, which existed in Italy, France, and Spain, and were fundamentally agitating for republics rather than monarchies. The crucial element that he took from the Carbonari was the circle system. So therefore, people only knew the colleagues in their particular group. They didn't, or circle, as they called them. They didn't know anybody else. And this was a very effective way of maintaining secrecy and integrity. They launched various unsuccessful attempts at insurrection. The Clan na Gael that the IRB created in 1867 in America went ahead and launched as the Fenians, and then they became enmeshed in parliamentary politics in the Irish Parliamentary Party. The Fenians in America, the Clan in America, organized a bombing campaign in Britain in the 1880s, where Tom Clark was involved with. And he was captured and sent to prison. And when he came out and went back to America, he was determined to revive the IRB, which he saw as having, in effect, withered on the vine. And so when he came back to Ireland in the early part of the last century, that was his mission, and that's what he did.
And you also have a very strong personal connection to the IRB because your father was a member and took part in the 1916 Rising, as well as then subsequently the War of Independence and the Civil War.
Yes, he was a firm Republican, and he was a member of the IRB. And it was because of him that I had a special access to his generation, to his colleagues. And I spoke to many people who hadn't spoken to anyone else beforehand, which was very, very valuable. I remember in particular Liam Deasy, who was just a tremendous, Joe O'Doherty, whose brother Seamus was president of the IRB. And being president of the IRB meant that theoretically they claimed to be president of the Irish Republic. And that republic was their creation as a means of withstanding the antagonism of the church, which was and is opposed to secret societies, and that the church's opposition had a deleterious effect on IRB recruitment. And so they came up with an idea that they were like a government in exile during the Second World War. They were the government of the Irish Republic, and therefore they had the same status and should be accorded the same status as any other fully formed state. This was reasonably successful in withstanding church opposition.
And those interviews, really quite astonishing, the range of people and the seniority of some of the people, including Eamon de Valera. And you were getting these insights into, you know, for example, when he found out about the treaty, you were getting insights into basically their take on this critical period of Irish history.
Well, that's absolutely right. I saw Dev when he was president still. He was in Áras an Uachtaráin. When I went to see him, and he had me sit to the left-hand side of his desk, because he said he was practically blind, but he could see something from the corner of his left eye. So I sat there, and he proceeded to employ the great politician's trick, which is to start talking and not stop. So you couldn't get a question in. But what he talked about was hearing about the treaty when he was in Limerick, and driving up to Dublin to find more. When I did get a question in, naturally, about the IRB, I could see from his movement that he'd hit a buzzer under the desk with his knee, and the next thing is an aide came in and said, "Mr. President, your next appointment is waiting." And so I had about half an hour with him, and then I was out. But I was delighted. I felt privileged to have met him, frankly.
And why do you think he did hit the buzzer? Why was he maybe reluctant to reminisce about those particular aspects of his radical career?
Well, I think, and this is just what I think. I think the fact is that that when you look at everything and stand back from it, he and Michael Collins early on were wrangling for leadership. I don't think Collins wanted to be the official top dog. He was perfectly happy to beaver away, you know, principally behind the scenes. He, representing the IRB, was actually not particularly interested in the constitutional approach that De Valera adopted. And so they were behind the scenes, they were frantically pulling against each other. I think that when Dev went to America to get support for an Irish Republic, part of his effort was to undermine the Collins's attachment and connections to John Devoy and Clan na Gael over there. I think in turn, Collins understood, as I'm sure did Dev, that Britain was not prepared to grant a republic. And that was simply a red line that Britain would not cross, which is why Collins was so upset about being sent as a delegate to the treaty negotiations, because he knew that they wouldn't get what they were asked to get. And this, I think, was all part and parcel of a hidden power play between him and Dev.
The IRB also had a huge cultural influence in the way it was involved and connected to the GAA and the Gaelic League and these other organisations, and the way it was able to recruit members through these cultural organisations, and the way, indeed, they influenced it.
Well, yes. I think, Patrick, that Irish nationalism, which was at the heart of the IRB's desire, Irish nationalism is fundamentally a cultural rather than a political affair. And the culture, Irish culture, is quite different from British culture. It's full of marvels and it's full of grandeur and full of imagination. I mean, the only kind of unhistorical figure that ever comes up in Britain is probably King Arthur. in Ireland, Cuchulainn and many others are often referred to in everyday conversation. And it was this erosion, this perceived erosion of Irish culture by English speaking, by the coming in of English, that really motivated the IRB and indeed Douglas Hyde and the Gaelic League really motivated them to oppose what they saw as the hidden undercutting of what it meant to be Irish.
Talk to me about the role of women in the IRB, because it seems that only a few women were ever officially members. What role did they play, and I suppose who were the most significant members?
There's only three women were ever actually officially members, but the most important woman involved was, of course, Kathleen Clark, Tom Clark's widow. And she was the one who Tom made sure had access to all the IRB records and particularly bank accounts. And it was she who determined upon Michael Collins as the person who should take things forward. So her role was enormously important. But women generally were not part of the IRB story. Cum na Mbun was of course very important. I'm glad to say greater recognition is being given to its history today. But that was not the IRB. The IRB was really a men-only club.
My thanks to John O'Byrne Ranelagh, the author of The Irish Republican Brotherhood, 1914 to 1924. The book is published in hardback by Irish Academic Press. And John, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Patrick, thank you for having me.
And that brings us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to my producer, Marisa Sullivan, and Peter Malloy on sound. We've got more debate and discussion next week, so hope you can join us then. We've been Talking History. Good night.